Hallelujah.
Welcome to this presentation from House of David Fellowship in Richmond, Virginia. We're going to be doing some things a little different today. In the past, we've been looking at the eighth day, but what we want to do is we want to kind of like regroup and come at it from a different perspective. All right, so what I've entitled this part of the presentation is the eighth day, starting at the beginning. Now, what we have already covered, David Johnson did a lot of work with John. And so the process that he went through allowed us to see a number of things. But what happened was is that when we had some interaction and some questions and discussion, what I discovered in listening to what people were saying is that we do not have a consensus here in our fellowship on the state of the dead and New Testament eschatology, which is the study of end times or end things. So there are some questions that we need to get sorted out on that before we can have a better understanding of the eighth day. So I'm looking forward to discovering what those answers are. One aspect that I want to bring to your attention is that we're going to address progressive understanding at some point, because some of the writers of the New Testament had an understanding in the beginning, but that if you look at their writings later on, you'll see that they changed. And I think that has to do with they were operating out of their knowledge, but then when their knowledge got corrected, then it shows up in the text. So we're going to see that. One of the things that we need to get some words and phrases defined, and I'm going to define a couple today. Most of them I am not going to define today, because we're going to allow their use in context to define them, and that's what we'll be working from. We need to do that, and we also need to understand some of the background of the parables before we tackle Revelation. So all these things will be part of the eighth day study. Now, one of the things I can pretty much guarantee is that I'm not going to address everything that you want to address today. So if you have questions or you have some thoughts, passages that need to be addressed, you've got to write them down so they don't get forgotten, so that I can get them, so that I can make sure that they get addressed, because they're probably not going to get addressed today. So please do not forget your questions. I'd like to see them. All right, so now I'm going to ask some questions. The first one is, how did people in the first century, both Gentiles and Jews, think and speak about the dead and their future destiny? That's one of the things that I'm planning on finding out. Okay, now the Jews and the Gentiles, I've separated them because I want to make clear that we're going to look at Gentile literature, and then we're going to look at Jewish literature, then we're going to look at the scriptures. So I want to know what they think about the dead. Second question is, what, if anything, did the word resurrection mean within the worldview of the first century? What did the word resurrection? I'm going to define the word resurrection. That's one of the ones I am going to define before we start. But this question, you would think that, well, the answer to that's really easy. But you'd be surprised to find out that it's not. So that's why I put it there. It's something that I want to get an answer to. Number three. In Acts 17, Paul is speaking, and he's talking about the unknown God, so y'all are familiar with that story. And so my question is, what would someone in Ephesus, Athens, or Rome have understood Paul to be talking about when he announced to them that the Messiah had been raised from the dead? What would they have understood? That's the question that I'm asking. All right. Anastasis is the Greek word for resurrection, and I put it there because eventually we're going to talk about that. So. And my fourth question, based on their current framework of beliefs, that would be someone in Ephesus, Athens, or Rome. We're talking about some big areas, population-wise, in the New Testament, they're talked about. If these people heard Paul talking about the Messiah being raised from the dead, based on their current framework and understanding, what would be the anticipated reaction? That's another question I won't answer. All right. Now, I have some observations. Why is it important about how these people were thinking, what they understood? When this person said this, what did they understand? All right. So I have an example, and I want to share it with you. If somebody was to say, I'm mad about my flat, and the person listening was American, what would be the answer? They're angry about their puncture. That's what an American would hear, I'm mad about my flat. But if you said the same thing to a person who was British, what would you get? They're enthusiastic about their living quarters. So it's all about the framework, mindset, belief structure of the person who's hearing. That's what you have to know. If you don't know that, then you don't know if they're American or British. And you're going to guess one of them, and you could be wrong, because it could be the other one. And now you're going to build a foundation on that, and everything you build is going to be an error, because you did not find out what their framework was when you got there. Okay? By the way, this comes from, you've heard me speak of N.T. Wright. Well, this was his professor at Oxford who this quote comes from. So I wanted to put that up there for you. All right, continuing my observations. I've created a new word, Yeshuic Judaism. Okay? I want to make very clear, Yeshuic Judaism. All right, now, the claim of Yeshuic Judaicites of Yeshua's resurrection fell within the worldview and language of Second Temple Judaism. This is a fact. Second Temple Judaism was existing at the time of Yeshua's resurrection. And the Yeshuic Judaites had to deliver that message. That's what this is. I'm making a statement. Okay, next. Nowhere within Judaism or paganism is a sustained claim advanced that resurrection has actually happened to a particular individual ever. Doesn't exist anywhere. Which means we have a major mutation in thinking patterns. Out of nowhere, people are talking about resurrection. And there's no basis for it. We need to find out about that. Okay? That's what that observation is. In addition, that claim was quickly advanced within the wider non-Jewish worldview of the first century. What did Paul say in Acts? Okay, you guys do not consider yourselves worthy to hear this. I'm going to take it out here, and they will hear. So this concept about resurrection was taken to non-Jewish people very soon after the fact. Okay, that's my statement. All right. So, we need to know if they're American or British. We need to find this out. So, my question is, how do we learn about the first century worldview? How do we find out what they were thinking, what they believed, etc.? How do we find that out? So, now comes to the question that all of you all are probably wondering about the literature that you're reading that is associated with this presentation. All right? Here is that question. I'm reading all this pagan literature. What am I supposed to get from all this stuff? That is the question. All right. So, I'm going to explain how this works. One of the sciences that I particularly like is called archaeology. Now, there's a bunch of sciences I like, paleontology and cosmology, things of that nature. But I'm going to speak about archaeology because I want to use that as an example so you can understand what you are to take away from reading this material. All right, let's say that during an archaeological dig of Jewish tombs from the first century, what they are discovering is when they get to the area where the skull is, there's a coin there. In 90% of the skulls, there's a coin. Well, we can go through the Hebrew Tanakh And you will not find anywhere where it says that you should put a coin in the mouth of a deceased person before you bury him. It's just not there. It's not there. But 90% of the Jews in the first century were putting a coin in their deceased's mouth. Why is that? Okay, so, by the way, Biblical Archaeology Review is a good journal if you're looking for a good journal to read. Okay, all right, so, if we look at the Bible, we see it's not there. So what is left? We have to look at non-biblical writings. So if we were to go back to the period a millennia before the birth of Yeshua and begin to look at death and burial as far as how the pagans did it, you'll see for a few hundred years there's nothing there that relates to this concept of a coin being in the mouth. But then suddenly, there begin to evolve stories about ghosts and spirits who want to pass over the river of separation after they die, but they can't get across because they don't have the money to pay the boatman to carry them across the River Styx. That's S-T-Y-X. That's in pagan literature. Okay. And so then what happens is, over time, moving forward toward the birth of Christ, even if people cannot afford a funeral, the town comes together to make sure that they have enough of a collection made so that they can get a coin to put it even into the mouth of a poor person so their spirit does not roam aimlessly wanting to get over to a place of rest but not able to. That's what they believe. Okay, so, you know, now we can look at that and say, well, that's stupid. But I'm not here to judge. I'm collecting data, okay? So, let's bring that up now to the first century. You may be Jewish, going to the synagogue on the Sabbath, keeping the feasts, temple, doing sacrifices, and all the other things that you're doing. But when it comes time to bury one of the deceased in your family, you make sure they have a coin in their mouth. What does that tell me? That tells me that you are observing the commandments as you understand them, but the worldview of paganism has penetrated within your mind so much, and you don't even know it. That's what it tells me. They've been influenced by that. So, one of the passages that I like is Romans 12:2. And what it says is, do not be conformed to this world view. Now, what is the word that happens to a caterpillar when they become a butterfly? Metamorphosis. All right? What's the Greek word in Romans 12:2? Be not conformed to this world, but experience metamorphosis. There's a change that takes place there. So combine that with 2 Corinthians 10:5, where it says we are to bring every thought into the captivity of Christ. That helps us pull down paganism. But these people were keeping the commandments, going to the temple, doing these things, and they were consumed with paganism and didn't even know it. All right? We see that because the worldview got them and they did not have the luxury of having Romans 12:2 until it got written. Okay? So, all right, now, I am going to demonstrate how we are to do this with a case study. Okay? And here's my case study. We're going to use first century language and understanding to write the New Testament. I shall continue. All right. Here's a word. Mark knows this word well. Palin. I have written it with a second ending there. You can see that it's P-A-L-I-N, but on the line where Freiburg is, You'll see that I've also added the G, the gamma, alpha, beta, gamma. The G is there because sometimes it has a G ending as well. So it's palin, peleg. You know how Greek is. They have all those strange things. Here's the definition of this word, denoting a return to a previous state. In other words, the word is translated again. And in the KJV, it's translated, palin's translated 142 times is the word again. All right. This is another definition from Freiberg, denoting repetition once more anew. Now, I need to give you some scriptural examples of the word palin in the New Testament. So I'm just going to start right at the beginning of the New Testament and go to Matthew. Yeshua said it unto him, it is written, palin, thou shalt not tempt Yahweh the Elohim. They translated it as again. It is written again. Again, you've heard it, that it has been said by them of old time. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man. Again, I say unto you, all of these places are places where the Greek word is palin, translated into English as the word again. Okay, are we good? Now, let's move forward. The next word is genesia. You can see I have it genesia. It is the Greek word for Genesis. All right? What I want to do is I'm going to put up palin, just so you can remember it. And I want you to remember back to the last time that we studied a compound word. That was September the 1st, 2012, 1 Timothy 2:12, where we found out about unauthorized authority. And how do we find it? We saw the compound word, so what is the first thing you do? You find out how's that word been used. So here's a word in the Greek New Testament, a compound word. I need to find out how that word is used in the dictionary the New Testament writers use. What was the dictionary of the New Testament writers? The Greek Tanakh. That was their dictionary because they had to convey Hebrew concepts using the Greek language. So that was their dictionary. So, we went at 1 Timothy 2:12 into the Greek Bible and we found out that that word did not exist in the Greek Bible. So, that told us that we had to find out what that word meant in contemporary worldview literature of the first century. So, what we did was, is we went outside the scriptures and went to all of the Greek literature that exists and looked up the use of that word and then saw the example of exactly how it applied. And we understood it there. Okay? Well, we're going to do the same thing here again. I have showed you about palin, or peleg, and genesia. Okay, so if you put them together, what do you get? Genesis again. Okay, Genesia, palin. Now, I'm going to use, I've used a lot of different lexicons and dictionaries. I'm going to use another one. Now, it's available for free online, so I'm just going to use this one as an example. It's called the New American Standard, New Testament Greek Lexicon. And here is what it says. The word is often used to denote the restoration of a thing to its pristine state. Now, here is one of the problems that we in the Hebrew Roots movement sometimes find ourselves as poor archaeologists in our study of the word. And I want to demonstrate that. When I'm reading a lexicon, and I'm guilty of it too, I have to be focused and retrain my mind that this is what I'm doing. What do we deal with on the Sabbath? Do you have bills that need to be paid? You have people you need to talk to or go to or do something with? You got things that you need to do at the house? You may have some things that are coming from your job. You want to prepare yourself. All those things exist in real time. Guess what? You set them aside on the Sabbath. You're not here and here consumed with your business life or everything else you have to do. If you allow them in, they become a distraction. And then you cannot focus on those things that are part of our Sabbath day. Once a week, we got this time to set it Just set them outside, and I'll get back to you in a few hours. Okay? Well, we do the same thing with study. Okay? Now, look at this. This sentence here, the word is often used to denote the restoration of a thing to its pristine state, blah, blah, blah. This is the most important sentence here in this presentation. And I'm going to show you why. Because look at this. What is the most important word in this sentence? Often. The word palingenesia is often used to denote the restoration of a thing to its pristine state. Now, what does often mean? That means it's used twice? Probably not. Probably used more often than twice. All right, so I'm sitting here, and I'm doing this study, and I'm preparing for this presentation. And I'm reading, the word is often used to denote the restoration of a thing to its pristine state. So what am I going to do? I'm in the New Testament. I got my Greek New Testament. Here's what I'm going to do. I pull up my Bible Works screen. You can see it right there. I thought you could see it. There it is. Greek. That is Greek New Testament Matthew. And you can see the Greek there. And look, I've highlighted palingenesia in Greek. I right-click. I scroll down to search on form in LNX. In 2 seconds, I can tell you every time, every place this word has shown up in the Greek Bible. And then right below that, search on root in BLM is the morphology. It's another database of the Septuagint. Just like Hebrew, Greek has roots. And so I'm able to search for the roots that are involved with this word in the Greek Bible. And I can tell you immediately just what I got, how many of these, and then I can go look up all those passages and see what they mean. It's right there. This is what I do. So now I just consume 4 seconds of my study to get this done. All right? Now, what did I find out? The word doesn't show up in the dictionary. It's not there. We have a problem. They did not use the Greek Bible when they put this word in. So what have I got to do? I've got to do the same thing that I did with 1 Timothy 2:12. I have to go out and find out where Genesis again took place. Okay? So I did. And guess what I found out? From the Stoics, the beginning again of the world to take place after its destruction by fire. This is the word they use to mean that. All right? Again, that restoration of the primal and perfect condition of things which existed before the fall of the first parents. That's what the word means. That's how it was used by pagan literature, not by the Greek LXX. This is the word chosen to put into the text that I am now going to read you right now. What does it say? Yeshua said unto them, verily I tell you the truth. You that have followed me at palingenesia, which is at Genesis again, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Interesting. This is where it occurs. And this is the context that it's written in. All right. So, as an archaeologist, if I go to a dig and it happens that the treasure I'm looking for is 3 feet down, but I only dig 1 foot here, 1 foot here, 1 foot here, 1 foot here, and then I throw up my arms and say, there's nothing here, moving on to a different site, what a treasure I just lost. So when we are looking at texts, we must be focused and push away the distractions. They're real, they're true, they're fine, they need to be dealt with. But today, I'm going to find out what it means that this word is often used to mean this. I'm going to find out. Because this is not part of the Old Testament lexicon. So, now, let's move on. I've got some definitions that I want to make sure that I can explain clearly, because you're going to see these words as we read some things. The first one. What is death? There was life, but it's come to an end in the flesh. That is our opening definition for death. Resurrection. Life without end after life after death. Okay? Notice I've connected life after death with dashes. I want you to see that as one phrase. What do we know about Yeshua's life after death? He had flesh and bones. His old injuries were visible. He can consume food. He's not constrained by standard molecular boundaries. What that means is that he appeared in rooms in which the doors were closed. He went through the walls, whatever he did. He was not constrained by standard molecular boundaries that we face. His face was recognizable, and on the road to Emmaus, he had concealed his identity. Now, how much of that we get to do, I don't know. Particularly the last one is questionable. But Peter says we'll be like him. So, you know, we got something working here. And here is our anastasis, a fresh living embodiment, following a period of death as a state. Death as a state means that you were alive in the flesh and then you officially died. So now you're in what is known as death as a state. So anastasis is a free, fresh, living embodiment following a period of death as a state. Okay? You're going to see that Greek word at some point in time. So let's review my question. I had four. This is the one I want you to be focused on and thinking about. How did people in the first century, both Jews and Gentiles, think and speak about the dead? One. Think and speak about the dead. Two, about the dead's future destiny. We want to find that out. That's what we are doing in this opening section. First, just so we can be clear, there is a lot of classical literature in the millennia that we covered. I did not mean for my assignment to appear to be exhaustive, because it was not. There's more than I sent out. I only sent out some. There is more than what I sent out. Okay? Two, what I tried to do to be reasonable was, I'm going to call it a sampling of literature, because the pieces that I picked and the sections of those stories that I picked speak to the subject at hand. That's why I did what I did. But there are more and more, right? What we want to learn about in reading this literature is non-Jewish concepts of after death, which we just defined. Okay, so here we go. The intro is over. We're going to start with concepts about resurrection. Our first reading is from the Iliad, and here's what it says. Mourn as you may for your brave son, you will take nothing by it. You cannot raise him from the dead. All right? Our next reading, Eumenides. But when the thirsty dust sucks up man's blood, once shed in death, he shall arise no more. All right, so far, seem to have a level of consistency. Electra, but never by laments or prayers shalt thou recall thy sire from the lake of Hades, to which all must pass. Nay, thine is a fatal course of grief, passing ever from due bounds into a cureless sorrow, wherein there's no deliverance from evils. All right? Herodias. This is a story. A guy sent this other servant off to kill somebody, but there was a screw-up. Okay, so the guy comes back and he's chewing him out, and the story is a great story, but I'm not interested in the story. When he's chewing him out, the guy's saying, listen, I did the job right. Let me tell you, if of a truth the dead can leave their graves, In other words, if it's possible that the dead can leave their graves, expect this guy to come back and fight against you. But if the course of nature be the same as it always has been, then be sure no ill will ever come upon thee from this fellow that I put to death. So as you can see here, he is doing an if statement. If the guy can rise from the dead, you're in trouble. But if life continues the way it has always been, he's dead, man. You ain't got nothing to worry about. That's what the text says. So, in just these simple samples, what have we got? Once people have died, they do not return. That's what we've got so far. All right? What about in the mythical writings? Because these were all stories of people. The mythical writings are a little more mythical. All right. First one is Pathian by Pindar. And here's what it says. But even skill is enthralled by the love of gain. In other words, a principle taught in the New Testament about the love of money. Gold shining in his hand turned even that man for a handsome price to bring back from death a man who was already caught. In other words, he was paid off to go into Hades and get somebody who was already dead and bring them back to life. He was sent to do it. Zeus killed them both, kept them from being resurrected. So even in a mythical thing, this is not even true. This is just a myth story, fiction performed on stage. Zeus would not allow anybody to be resurrected. And he's the top god, as far as I know. Okay? So resurrection not even in myth. What about the first century position? Normally I would not jump all the way to the first century, but I just want you to understand, since in the end, what we're shooting for is what did the first century understand? I'm quoting a famous writer who also talks about Christian stuff in a different writing. Okay, his name is Pliny the Elder, and his work is The Natural History. This is somewhat long, but I'm going to explain it as we go so you can see. All men, after their last day, which means when they died, return to what they were before they were born. And after death, there is no more sensation left in the body or in the soul. Notice that. No more sensation left in the soul either. This is his position. Than there was before the person was born. But this same vanity of ours, and you can see already how he's coming here, prejudicial statement, but the same vanity of ours extends even to the future and lyingly fashions to itself an existence even in the very moments which belong to death. In other words, they're making up some stuff about what happens in the instant you die. At one time, this is just one of them, it was conferred upon us the immortality of the soul. This will be handled later under the topic category of immortality of the soul. At another, transmigration. You know what transmigration is? Reincarnation. We'll cover that under the category of reincarnation or recycling gone terribly awry. And at another, it has given sensation to the shades below. Shades is just another term. It's a different Greek word, but it's talking about the spirits. Paid divine honors to the departed spirit, thus making a kind of deity of him who has but just ceased to be a man. Pretty clear on how he feels. For what is the actual substance of the soul? Yeah, where are we going to find that information? When taken by itself, of what material does it consist? Where is the seat of its thoughts? How is it to see or hear or how to touch? And then, of what use is it or what can it avail if it has none of these faculties? If it can't see, it can't hear, it can't touch, can't think, what good is it? This is his question. Whereto is its residence? Does it have a cell phone number? And what vast multitudes of these souls and spirits must there be after the lapse of so many ages? Overcrowding. We have lots of problems here. But all these are the mere figments of childish ravings, and of that mortality which is so anxious never to cease to exist. In other words, people had some wild imaginations because they don't want to stop living. It is a similar piece of vanity, too, to preserve the dead bodies of men, just like the promise that he shall come to life again, which was made by Democritus, who, however, never has come to life again himself. So, probably a false prophet. Okay, we have to define a word. Credulity. Probably not pronouncing that correctly, but that's how I'm going to say it. A tendency to be too ready to believe that something is real or true. Why am I quoting this word? Because it shows up in the next quote. The ancient author used this word. I want to make sure you understand what this word means. A tendency to be too ready to believe something is true or real. Okay? A state of willingness to believe in one or many things in the absence of reasonable proof or knowledge. Just tell me so I can believe it. Credulity is not simply belief in something that may be false. The subject of the belief may even be true. But a credulous person will believe it without evidence. Bad. And it stresses uncritically forming beliefs. You are ready to believe it, and you are not critically thinking through it. I'm just going to believe it because this guy said it. Okay? Credulous person. All right, let's go back. What does he say? What downright madness it is to suppose that life is to recommence after death. This pleasing delusion and this credulity double the misery of him who is about to die by anxiety as to what is to happen to him after it. People are stressed. What's going to happen to me? There's even a story of a rabbi who's getting ready to die. He says, I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. Around his students. And they're thinking, my goodness, if he ain't going to make it, I ain't got no hope. People are stressed about dying if they don't know where they're going. His solution. How much more easy it is than to be guided by our knowledge of what our state has been before birth. Yeah, how many people know how I was doing before I was born? Yeah, whatever that is, I'm going to assume that after I'm dead, that's where I'm going to be. That's his solution. All right? So, even in the first century, for many, there's no life at all beyond the grave. That's for many. All right? Now, from the underworld, there's an exception. Okay, there's one exception. This is Alcestis. Here is the situation. A man had a wife. Her name was Alcestis. She died. When Hercules came to the door to visit, kind of like to visit for a while, obviously the family is upset, distraught even. But the man puts on a good face and tells Hercules that this is just a stranger. And so Hercules is like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. If it's just a stranger, you know, we'll just hang out. All right? Then the truth is revealed that it's not just a stranger, but this was actually his wife. And Hercules is like all upset because this man, who should have been in mourning instead, put on a face of grace and invited Hercules in to stay and to feast, etc. So Hercules makes this statement. I must save this dead woman and bring back Alcestis to this house as a grace to Admetus. Love these names. I shall watch for death. Remember, this is a play on stage. This is a play on stage. And Hercules is up there and he's saying, I'm going to watch for death, the black-robed lord of the dead. And I know I shall find him near the tomb drinking the blood of the sacrifices. And over here is a person wearing a black robe heading toward the blood is on the stage. If I can leap on him from an ambush, seize him, grasp him in my arms, no power in the world shall tear his bruised sides from me until he has yielded up this woman. This is what Hercules is saying to himself. If I miss my prey, if he does not come near the bleeding sacrifice, I will go down to his hometown in the sunless dwelling, and I will make my request to them, and I know that they'll give me her so I can bring them back to the host. So he does it, succeeds in bringing her back. She's got some issues, but then she dies again. All right? So what do we got? There's our exception from the underworld of resurrection. All right. Continuing. Another form of resurrection. Cheating death. From Plato's Republic. Here we have. I added the word tall just so that we can be sure of what's going on here. A tale about Ur. He was slain in battle, and 10 days afterwards, when the bodies of the dead were taken up, already in a state of corruption, his body was found unaffected by decay and carried away home to be buried. That was your first hint. And on the 12th day, as he was lying on the funeral pile, he returned to life and told them what he had seen in the other world. He said that when his soul left the body, he went on a journey with a great company, and that they came to a mysterious place at which there were two openings in the earth. Two physical openings. They were near together, and over against them were two other openings in the heavens. In the intermediate space there were judges, who commanded the just. Who commanded the just. And after they had given judgment on them and had bound their sentences in front of them, to ascend by the heavenly way on the right side, and in like manner the unjust were bidden by them to descend by the lower way on the left side. These also bore the symbols of their deeds, but fastened on their backs. So now we got a split going on here. He drew near, and they told him, "You will be the messenger who will carry the report of this other world back to men." And they told him he needed to hear and see all that was to be heard and seen in that place. Okay? Let's continue with The Myth of Ur by Cicero. Writing about the Commonwealth in imitation of Plato, has related the story of the return of Ur to life, who, he says, had come to life again after he had been placed on the funeral pile, and related many secrets about the shades below, not speaking like Plato, in a fabulous imitation of truth, but using a certain reasonable invention of an ingenious dream, cleverly intimating that these things which were uttered about the immortality of the soul and about heaven, they're not inventions, nor are they fables, but they are the stories of wise men. But the Platonic relator of secrets was a man by the name of Ur, a soldier by profession, who, after he appeared to have died from wounds received in battle, and 12 days after was about to receive the honors of the funeral pile with the others who were slain at the same time, suddenly either recovering his life, or else never having lost it, as if he were giving a public testimony, related to all men all that he had done or seen in the days that he had thus passed between life and death. Although Cicero, as if himself conscious of the truth, grieves that this story has been ridiculed by the ignorant, still, avoiding giving an example of foolish reproach, he preferred speaking of the relator as one awakened from a swoon, rather than restored to life. How many people have read the Passover plot? It's based on this story. All right, one more. This one is a sad one. This is a couple people who got married. Here's the plot outline. The story is based on some events in 400 BC. These two marry, but some people trick the husband into thinking the wife's been unfaithful, so he kicks her so hard she falls over dead. I always hate to hear that. There's a funeral. She's shut up in the tomb. Then it turns out she was only in a coma and wakes up in time to scare the thugs who have opened the tomb to rob it. So they kidnap her and sell her as a slave. My conclusion, you can't experience resurrection until you actually die. Okay? So, concepts about resurrection. There's no life after life after death, except for that one exception, and we'll see that again in the New Testament. Okay. So, here is my conclusion to this first part of the presentation. Think back to my introduction, where we're talking about the coin found in the skulls, and then looking at the history by reading the literature, we see that at a certain time, people began to discuss that you have to cross over a river to get to the place where your dead soul will rest. Otherwise, you will just roam aimlessly and never be at peace. So make sure you bury me and you put a coin in my mouth. Okay? That's what people understood. That's what the Jews did in the first century. So, let me ask you this question. Suppose I come along and I want to teach a higher spiritual truth to these people. Okay? So, let's say I use these concepts and symbols that these people not only are fully familiar with, but actually incorporate into their lives in the story to make my point. What is that called? It's called a parable. All I'm doing is taking what you know and what you do is putting the coin in. No, it's paganism. But if I use that concept to tell a story about a higher spiritual truth that you can identify with, that's a parable. That is what a parable exists as. So, as we are reading through this literature and informing ourselves of what the pagans believed as they progressively approach from dead and nothing to dead and please pay the fare to dead, let's have a party, to etc. As the progressive understanding takes place and we get to the first century, all we're doing is informing ourselves of the worldview that the Jewish people thought was true, but wasn't. And so when higher spiritual truths are taught them in the scriptures through parables, using things that they are fully familiar with, it doesn't necessarily mean that all of the literal things that are said are true, especially if they disagree with the body of understanding about certain concepts. So there's your parable. And so, that is the end of this first section. I will take questions now.